Take it away, Stephanie.
Okay, well, welcome everyone. Thank you so much for coming. We're going to begin by just reviewing last month's meeting notes. Everyone have a copy with them?
I move to approve.
Thank you.
Who's second?
Remy.
Oh, Remy.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right, so we have someone new joining us today. We're happy to have Tracy Cruz. And would you be willing to just say a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, hi, I'm Tracy Cruz, and I'm a registered nurse, and I'm currently undergoing a community health and population-focused nursing project. I appreciate the members coming here and sitting on the meeting. My project is in the area of radon. I know that I haven't seen anything as far as that being on the topic of this meeting, but I'm going to join you and listen in and see where it's going.
Okay. Wonderful, thank you. To help out with that, too, I was wondering if we could all just go around and quickly just introduce ourselves and know what your position is with the council. So my name is Stephanie Royce-Masha. I'm a nurse practicing in Clark County.
Mark Collier, representing technical designers, installers, and maintenance people.
John Roth,
I
represent public utilities and representing water providers.
Dave Fuller, the director of Clark Regional Emergency Services Agency.
Remy Houston, representing Clark County Dental Society.
I'm Kathleen Lofgren, I'm an epidemiologist at Clark County Public
Health. I'm Adrienne Fairbanks, I'm a veterinarian on the board of the veterinary
position. I'm Kelly Espinoza, I represent Legacy Salmon Creek, I'm the chief nursing officer there.
I'm
Arun
Murthy, and I'm a psychiatrist at
the Vancouver Clinic.
Jeff Harbison, I'm the Chief Administrative Officer with Clark County Public Health.
Paul Childers, I represent the restaurants of Clark County.
Alan Mellick, I'm the Director and the Health Officer of Clark County Public Health. Mm-hmm.
Marla Sanger, I'm the Director for Community Benefit at Peace Health for both St. John Medical Center and the Southwest Medical Center.
And I'm
Roxanne Wolf, I'm the Chief
Operations Officer for both
Clark County. And I'm Bob Wilson, the Police Chief of Battleground, and I represent the LEC, which is all the police chiefs and the sheriff in Clark County.
Don Sturick, I do communications for Clark County Public Health.
Hi, I'm Joan Cayley, I'm a nurse, but I sit on the council as the non-elected representative from the City of Vancouver.
I'm Amy Bishop-Smith, I'm the youth representative on the council.
Melanie Maiorino, I'm the Behavioral Health Ombuds.
I'm Lydia Gurman with Public Health.
Janice Koch, Chief Performance Officer, Public Health.
Great. Well, I'm also very excited that we have someone that has filled the position for the federally recognized tribe member. However, Debbie wasn't able to make it, so we hope that we'll be able to meet her in the next meeting. So right now, I just wanted to take a couple of minutes to see if there's anyone that has any comments for the group about projects, maybe, or updates.
I have a question about the Daybreak tour that they're going to take next month on the 18th. Mm-hmm. I was wondering if anyone can go to that, or...
Yeah, so right now... we have a time, and all the public health board members were, or not the board members, but the advisory council was invited to that.
Okay.
So beyond that, I don't know if there was a discussion about others. I know it seemed like.
I don't know. Is the Daybreak?
Steve is not here.
Yeah, Steve's not here to ask.
It's something we can follow up with him and ask.
Okay.
I'll do that.
Okay.
Stephanie, I have two things. One, that ACES Action Alliance is moving right along. We have our meeting next week. It would be great if some of the council would be interested in attending. The ACES Action Alliance continues to grow, and in volume and in diversity. We now have over 200 individual members and over 60 organizations. And our meeting next month, we're going to be doing some follow-up in terms of last month we had some representatives from the Latino community talking about the impact on families of some of the changes in immigration policies. It was a very, very poignant, sort of heartbreaking meeting, hearing the stories. And, you know, again, our goal on the Action Alliance, we're not getting political, we're trying to think, what can we do to support families? So the meeting next week, we're going to be debriefing that, talking about what is it that individuals in the community can do to support these families. So that meeting is on the 20th. I forgot my phone in the car, so I can't look at the book on Wednesday. Wednesday, I think it's Wednesday at the ESC.
The 26th.
And then as I drove in, I finished listening to The Unthinkable, the book that was recommended to us last month at Cressa. So if anybody wants to borrow it, it's really a good book. I listen to a lot of audiobooks because I do so much driving. So I recommend it. I highly recommend it. Scott recommended it. And it's a good book. So if anybody wants to borrow the books on tape, I'll loan it to you. And if not, I highly recommend it. It's a very good read. That's all I have.
It's a book on tape?
It's on CD. Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
CD.
Yeah. So if you want to borrow, just see me afterwards and I'll let you borrow.
All right, then moving on to kind of department updates. So, Alan, you're going to talk to us about the legislative updates?
Yeah, very briefly. So, for those of you who are Foundational Public Health Services, we had a bill. It was originally called House Bill 1432. It made it through the House and got out of the House, and then it kind of ended up kind of in the Senate Ways and Means Committee. It didn't move beyond that. And there's a piece about the legislation itself that defines Foundational Public Health Services and basically say they need to be available everywhere. The governor, and then there's a budget piece. So the governor, so we had originally asked, is public health, and if you remember, I think I probably waxed about this before, we had asked for $60 million for the next biennium, because that's what we think would be a good investment in terms of taking care of Foundational Public Health Services. The governor proposed $20 million, which is better, and we were together with the State Department of Health in this legislation. The governor proposed $20 million, which would have been better than nothing, certainly. The House actually put in $40 million, and the Senate put in zero. And the bill kind of died, but it's not really dead, because there's something called NTIB. I don't know if any of you are familiar with NTIB, but bills that somehow don't make it can still live if they're included in something called Necessary to Implement the Budget. So Foundational Public Health Services legislation lives, but we're gonna have a special session because the Senate and the House can't agree on the budget, and there will be a special session, and Foundational Public Health Services will be there as, even though the bill died, it'll be in there as NTIB. I don't know if anybody has any questions about that. So that's a good thing, it's still living. The other thing about tobacco in 21, that also didn't make it, but that's also NTIP. So that still has some links to it as well. And then the drug take back, basically that one's dead. So that's my summary of the legislative update in terms of some of the bills that you guys might all be interested in. I don't know if anybody has any questions. But in terms of the Foundational Public Health Services, this is still good time to advocate. I should tell you that our delegation is pretty good on this one. Senator Rivers has actually taken a leading role in supporting Foundational Public Health Services. So the difficulty is not with our delegation so much as it's elsewhere in the state. So it didn't get out of committee because I think was it Senator Schuster, I'm not sure I'm getting his name correctly, believed that there was a requirement for $60 million, and there wasn't, but it somehow died in the committee, and that's how it got into NTIB. So, but it's still there.
It was a great editorial in the Columbia.
Oh, well, thank you. Did people see that? So we actually, what a lot of us have been trying to do is get our editorial boards to write something about this, because the legislators pay attention to what the editorial board. So, and you guys should know this, I went with Councillor Olson, who's great. We went down and met with, they agreed to meet with us. We met with the editorial board, and then they wrote that editorial. It basically says fund, invest, I think it's, the title was invest in public health. You guys know how to get it. Councillor Olson was really, you know, great advocate for public health, and the Columbian, I thought, did a really, really wonderful job with it. So thank you for noticing that. But the other thing about that is feel free to write letters to the Columbian, thanking them for that and expressing your support for public health and foundational public health services. Okay, that was, I already went longer than I needed to.
That's good.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and Jeff, you're
going to
give us an update on the
state
budget status?
Yeah, very quickly. As I mentioned, the state Senate and state House have both passed budgets. The next step, which they're in now, there is a reconciliation process where the Senate and the House come together and develop a budget for the governor to sign, a single budget. All conventional wisdom is it will take a special session. The regular session ends April 23rd, so we're only a few days away. It might take multiple special sessions. We're waiting to see how this plays out. The Federal Prevention and Public Health Fund, PPHF for short, it's actually, we've talked about this in the past. It's embedded within the ACA, Affordable Care Act. As of right now, the ACA is still in place. And as long as the ACA is in place, the Prevention and Public Health Fund is also in place. 13% or 12% of the CDC budget is in that fund. We actually receive funding directly from that fund as well. So it's of special interest to us. So we'll bring back any updates as that may or may not change.
Can I just add on? It may be worthwhile to contact Herrera Butler's, Congressman Herrera Butler's office, and express your support for the Prevention and Public Health Fund. It's about 12% of the CDC budget, and if it gets cut, a lot of that money, significant amount of that money comes to us, and it would be a negative impact here, especially around things like immunizations, preparedness. So contacting Herrera Butler's office, she's a key legislator in terms of this stuff.
Jeff, if the after the special sessions, what is the deadline that they need to make their decisions and have a budget made before the government shutdown starts?
So if there's not a budget passed by midnight on June 30th, or 11:59 on June 30th, whatever, they risk a government shutdown on July 1st, which I actually watched a few years ago. They passed a budget late at night on June 30th.
Mm-hmm. Oh, by the way, we prepared a one-pager for Herrera Butler's office that we'd be happy to, we can share that with, forgot about that, so.
How do we get that?
Email it.
Okay.
And Roxanne, you're going to give us an update
on the NFP. So, pardon me, so there's a couple of things going on right now with NFP. I'm going to pass around a letter. Guys, a copy, and then I'll share this direction. So, NFP is, for those of you who are unaware, is our Nurse Family Partnership Program. It's called our Nurse Family Partnership Program, and most everyone is aware of that. It's a program that is an intensive case management program for first-time low-income moms and families in our community. And they do a significant amount of great work with these families, including work around mental health and substance use, and providing referrals to mental health treatment, working with families on violence within their communities and things or within their families and those sorts of things. So it's a very, very important program for our community, and we've been working to find sustainable funding for it for a while. And that's been a challenge for us since we've had some budget cuts over the past few years. So last year, no, was it this year? I think it was this year, right, Jeff? We requested, or was it last year? Requested the mental health.
That was last year.
Last year, we requested a one-time allocation from the mental health sales tax fund, which had a fund balance, and we requested a one-time allocation from that fund to sustain the NFP program as we have some community dialogue with our partners to look at more long-term sustainability for the program. It qualifies for mental health sales tax, and that was one of the reasons why the counselors approved it for that one-time ask. However, since things have happened with the Affordable Care, or with the change in administration and all of the changes with the Affordable Care Act, that has impacted some of the partner discussions that we're having because people are just a little bit unsure as to where funding is going to go. So we are, our dialogue with different partners has been slowed because of that. And so what we have done is we are looking to go back to our council and ask them for some ongoing support out of that fund. The other bullet point on your agenda is the designated state health program. We also became aware of a new program that will allow a federal match of funds up to 1-to-1 for qualifying programs, and NFP is a qualifying program. What the designated state health plan requires is that funding, it comes from either a state or a local general fund or the mental health sales tax. So basically, this is going to allow us to go to our counselors and actually leverage these dollars, and that's what the ask is right now. We have requested in the supplemental budget that's going to be heard in May to allow an ongoing $400,000 a year budget allocation for the NFP program to leverage these federal funds. And what we're asking is, the letter in front of you is asking FAP to, if you would be amenable to supporting this with our counselors via the letter that we drafted. So we wanted to open it up for some conversation. We have some, we think it's a really great opportunity because number one, NFP is being recognized, across the nation, but certainly in the state as a very important program. Number two, it allows us an opportunity to really leverage funds. It also offers us an opportunity to show to our partners who are interested in helping fund the program that there is support from our county to continue this program as well. So we see a lot of upsides from this program or from this ask, and we're hoping that the counselors will see the benefit. So we are asking if you would be amenable to submitting a letter to the council from Stephanie on behalf of the FAP to support this. And we wanted to open it up, though, if there are any questions. I kind of went over it at a very high level, but are there any specific questions around the funding or?
Yes.
Oh, sure.
So I just wanted to mention that I become a lot better informed about this program. The thing that really jumps out at me is that it's been around for more than 30 years, and so there's a lot of longitudinal data. They've done scientifically appropriate examination of the outcomes of the program and have found that the mothers and the children who have been benefited by this program have outcomes that go on into their life, starting with readiness for kindergarten all the way up through high school and beyond. So it's got a proven track record, and in terms of going upstream and dealing with social determinants of health, it's about as upstream as you could ever get. So it's really a great program, and I'm so impressed with it that I've been working with Roxanne and Dr. Melnick to see if we can leverage some funding from Peace Health to be one of potentially other partners that would want to come together and see this program not only be sustainable, but also hopefully expand, because we're not reaching all of the people that could benefit by it right now.
What is the approximate amount of time that is spent with the mother or the family? Because I see that you're saying that it's evidence-based, high intensity, and long-term. Mm-hmm. About how long?
Yeah, so we basically, with the mom and the family, we spend about 2.5 years.
Okay.
So we want the moms to be enrolled in the program while they are still pregnant,
mm-hmm.
so that we can help them with prenatal care and other things. And then we work with them until the child is 2 years old. And we also, during that period of time, we work on a variety of issues with the mom and with the family. And hopefully the family's still together, but if it's not, then it's just with the mom. A lot of our moms are teen moms. I mean, mm-hmm. most of our moms, actually, over 50% are teen moms. And as young as 13.
Wow.
So there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of issues with these moms. And a lot of times they're not, you know, what we provide over and above, you know, services and this intensive kind of case management is we provide a responsible adult mentor in the form of a public health nurse who goes into the home and meets with the family and meets with the mom and makes sure that the mom has what she needs to be a great parent and to be successful in her own right and successful as a parent. So we also do a lot around, you know, teaching about, you know, what stages of development can you expect from your child. So, you know, you can imagine when I was 13, man, I don't know that I would have known that. So having someone there to teach those realistic expectations for those children, for the children as they grow, to also give support to those teen moms so that they can graduate from high school.
Mm-hmm.
We're very closely with the schools on that to make sure that they can stay in school. And you know, so the outcomes are far-reaching. So there's, you know, we work with them with regard to mental health issues, and sometimes there's violence within the family, so we work with them on that as well. Substance abuse issues and getting them, you know, helping them to get treatment for those as well, whether it's the mom or somebody else in the family, working with the family to help them in that regard as well. But also working with them to be successful and resilient people.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so this program is very far-reaching in a number of ways, and it impacts, as Marla said, it not only impacts the mom and the family, but that child later on.
Mm-hmm.
We show that, you know, there's more likelihood that the child who has benefited from the nurse-family partnership will actually themselves graduate from high school, less likely to be involved in juvenile justice and other things. So it's really, and again, being around for so many years, there's evidence, and the program is, there's a high degree of fidelity around the program, so
mm-hmm.
we keep, you know, that's very, very important with regard to making sure that those outcomes are accurate.
You're not passionate about this, are you?
But it's a really important program, and I think that, and I'm glad that you asked, because I think some people in here may be new and may not know that much about the program, so I appreciate mm-hmm. it.
Well, the 2 years and during the time that the mother's pregnant, it gives an opportunity for that trust
exactly.
to be formed,
exactly.
and I think that's excellent. Good work.
You know, I just this afternoon, this is something I talk about with my students, and just today I was talking with the community class, and I always talk about their family partnership, and the way I present it to my students is this is the gold standard of research. You know, it's where you can really see a return on investment. And, you know, just looking at the amount invested per family and then the return runs in, you know, some of the current numbers are the return to the taxpayer, because most of these kids, young women, are somehow on public assistance, runs, you know, upwards of $40,000 to $50,000 a year return on investment. And so it is, you know, it's if we talked about upstream thinking and, you know, as Marla says, a return, it's a good way to invest our money. The other thing is, I think it's important for some of the newer members of the council, Paul and Mark remember this, we were strong advocates in 2007 with the county commissioners at that point in time to fund the Nurse Family Partnership. We went to bat for this program for public health. And so for years, we've been a strong proponent of NFP. So I strongly urge us to send this letter forward.
How many families are in the program right now, and it sounds like there's also a much greater need than...
Yeah. So right now, and in fact, I just got some updated data. We have a total, since the inception of the program, we've served about 530 families. And right now, we have the ability, the capacity to serve, in Clark County, 100 families. We look at... We actually want to be able to expand that, though, because many times we actually have more people than we are able to get to. But we always look at the, quote, acuity of the cases. So we triage as
As we have referrals that come through, because we have so many, we have some limitations on the slots, we actually triage, and we make sure that we take those families that are the highest need. And then, but we don't just leave the others, we refer the others out to other programs so that they can still get services, even though we can't necessarily serve them at that time. Where do most of your referrals come in from? So we have several physicians that actually are very supportive of the program and other case managers. So we get referrals from Peace Health and from Legacy and some other OBGYNs within the community. We also get referrals from CMAR and some other case managers too. So a variety of different places.
Do schools ever refer?
Yep, the grads program. So yeah, that's the other places that we work very, very closely with the school system and the grads program too. So we get referrals from the school nurses as well.
Yeah. All right, so it sounds like everyone's on board with sending the letter.
I think we have.
Do we have to do a motion? Okay, does anyone have a motion?
I move we send the letter.
Second.
Wonderful. Now we are excited to hear from Catherine, who's going to tell us more about the Healthy Use Survey.
How are they asked to participate in this? Is it in a school program, a class?
They take this in school. Schools allocate like a class period so they can all.
Yeah, I'm actually in 10th grade. I took it. It was just during a class period, and they came in and said, hey, this is optional. It's not, you don't have to take it, but it's recommended. And yeah.
Okay.
Was it thought of, did anybody opt out, or was that?
No one in my class opted out.
I mean, it would probably be
little bit odd to opt out, so maybe everybody had a little bit of pressure to do the survey.
Yeah.
Which
is good, I guess. So is it like a health class? Or
right, no, but it's one
English class.
Yeah. Gonna,
not,
you don't want to be the one to do the survey. Yeah.
By the way, there are internal checks also, so kids that might try to game it, you could figure out whether they are or not.
Yeah, there's like a question in there with like a fake drug or something. So if they answered yes, they used this fake drug, their survey automatically gets thrown out.
So don't tell anybody.
You got insider info now.
Yeah. But anyway, so even though we saw marijuana use go down, the perception of harm is also going down. So this graph shows the perception of no or low risk of harm from using marijuana twice a week. So 31.3% of 10th graders found their thought that there was no or low risk of using marijuana regularly. And that's compared to 16.1% the most before. So we're seeing the perception of harm go down as well. And then the survey also asked about e-cigs. 11.2% of 10th graders engaged in the last month. This is also if they have engaged at least one time in the last month. And this is something that's very new, so the data is really interesting. I guess in 2004, it was like, or no, 2012, it was 4%. Of teenagers currently vaped, and then in 2014 it went up to 20%, and now it's back down to 11. So this is an area with a rapidly changing market and dynamics, so we're interested to see how it goes. But a lot of teenagers are also vaping with THC and nicotine, which makes it an area of concern. 2.6% of the 10th graders use vape products with THC, and 4.9% use vape products with nicotine. And not just the flavoring, so this is also something that we're keeping an eye on.
I was sitting at a stoplight the other day. I was sitting at a stoplight and I looked over at this car and I saw this person start blowing out the smoke until it filled the whole car. I couldn't even see the person after they got finished. And I'm like, how do they drive like that? They didn't even have their window down or anything. It just filled the entire car.
It's crazy.
So with cigarettes,
is it?
We're also seeing rates go down. 14.2% of 10th graders currently smoking cigarettes to 8.4% in 2016. But this is still significantly higher than Washington State as a whole, where 6.3% of 10th graders said they smoked cigarettes in the last month. And we're also seeing alcohol use go down. Also used marijuana in the last month. And
So I did this for all of the substances, as you can see here. Of those who use e-cigs in the past month, 63% also use marijuana. And then of those who use cigarettes in the past month, 63% also use marijuana in the past month as well. So this is a concern, especially because like the remixing of substances that are happening.
Can I ask, so I know there's been some controversy about whether marijuana can be considered kind of like a gateway drug to use like harder drugs. I don't know if that's, I read that some studies that say it is and then some say, you know, not really, doesn't predict, you know, people going on to use other drugs down the road. So I'm wondering, you know, what your take is on the data.
These data are cross-sectional, so they don't say anything about that. I think what's interesting, though, is that kids who use one type of drug are likely to use other drugs as well, but it doesn't say anything about whether any of these are gateways or not.
Do you know if, I have no idea, but do you know if there's any cost of vape, or if the access to something like that is easier or less easy than cigarettes? Is that something that you look at in some of this, or is that not really a contributing factor?
No, it can definitely be a contributing factor. And I'm not an expert either, but I think vaping is more expensive than buying cigarettes.
I think the initial investment is high.
Yeah,
but you got to buy all the stuff.
Once you make the investment, but after that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so you have to continue to buy packets.
And those are taxed as well, correct?
Is there a tax on, do you know?
On vaping?
Yeah.
You know, I don't know what the tax is on vaping. We can find out for you.
You don't need to find out, but I'm just curious.
Kids are very sensitive to price.
Yeah, well, I don't think if it's cheaper. Like,
that would be interesting, though, to look at the, you know, just the cost of a pack of cigarettes, the cost of, you know, if they were going to be smoking, just, you know, to some standard, you know, three times a week or something like that, look at the comparison of the cost.
Yeah, the HYS, the Healthy Youth Survey doesn't look at that. The other reason, for one of the reasons for the 21 and over for this was that kids who are 18 and over who can buy products now are in the same networks as younger kids. So a lot of times the younger kids get access to it from the older ones, as well as adults.
There's also interesting data in HYS that says what they are consuming when they are vaping. I don't know if you looked at that, but I know in our district and Clark County-wide, there's a lot of data that says that there's an actual slide that says if they're vaping, what's in it?
We just had THC and nicotine and yes.
Okay.
And 1.2% of them didn't even know what was in it.
Right. So there's a huge concern about vaping in general and the fact that it's gone up, but also that my personal opinion is that it's such a gateway because you can put nothing in it but cherry flavored or bubblegum flavored or something like that, and kids get used to the idea, and then from there they can fast forward. So I don't know what the data says, but we're very concerned.
The other thing about putting THC in a vaping product is that you don't have the characteristic smell that you do, but it's a lot easier to conceal it. So.
Well, and Sandy, is there still an issue with, it looks like a pen, and it looks like a writing device in the school, so many times the teacher is not aware, you know, in spite of the fact that there's, you know, there may be a smell or something, but they look like a pen. So mm-hmm.
You have mm-hmm. really bright children.
Yeah.
Who mm-hmm. love to do things, just like we all did when we were adolescents. They're amazing at figuring it out. Yeah, sure.
I don't know what the difference in the costs are, but I had a fellow that I worked with a few weeks ago tell me that he had started vaping because he wanted to quit smoking. Mm-hmm. And he he might have to go back to cigarettes because the vaping was beginning to cost him more. He was getting imported product for some reason, and I don't know. But again, I don't know what the difference is. But he just said that I may have to go back to smoking cigarettes because it's cheaper. Yeah. But yet, depending upon where you are, prices cigarettes are going up too.
Yeah.
So
I think the e-cigarettes are cheaper than the cigarettes themselves, but the vaping, I think, is relatively expensive. I just can't imagine doing something, whether it's vapor or smoke, that would fill my whole car full of smoke. You know, that just can't be healthy. I don't know.
Glad we're talking about this because it's a major concern for the county in terms of children. I know that in Battleground in the last 20 months we've had 5 children, 6 if you count the child who did not complete suicide but put a gun to her head, that have died. And I really believe as I go forward in my life that this concern in this county is something that we need to be very, very concerned with as a public health advisory and as a county as a whole. We have the resources for this adult problem right here to be figured out, and there are adult solutions for it, and we have the funding to help manage this, but this is gravely concerning. Last week there were 2 suicides, I believe, in Evergreen School District, and Battleground has had 5 in the last 20 months.
Wow.
And as we go through the next slides and we consider this, I'm going to, every single time I get an opportunity to talk about it, I'm going to do that. Because it's gravely concerning.
One of the trends that I recognized in just the last 6 months is the increase in males 19 to 21 years of age that are having their initial breaks and not able to cope with what's going on in life and have attempted suicide or have been inpatient more than 5 times in the last year. And so I took that to Beacon Health Options and I said, this is not good. This is a problem in our community. And they offered a contract. I believe Community Services Northwest has a contract for first breaks with males 19 to 21 years of age, their first breaks. But I mean, this is past this age, but that is something that we're doing in the community.
In the Battleground School District, and we're just one district, we're the 3rd largest in the county, but since September, because we have the opportunity to have a large SAMHSA grant, Substance Abuse Mental Health Services Administration grant, which is a research project, we've had 401 students in our community and families who are referred for mental health therapy services. 200 of those children are receiving those services in the 18 buildings we're in. And those services are being provided by our community mental health providers, which we have MOUs or memorandums of understanding with every single community provider that we can wrangle into my office to sit down and fill one out.
but that is 400 families to date. And I'll keep updating you on this, but that money is not sustainable. It's going away. And as a county, we need to be involved with how do we sustain these services and how we get our community providers in the very place that children are for 6.5 hours a day, every single day. And that data right there doesn't even reflect the very vast concern that we have in this community, in this county. Thanks for listening. But it is a passion.
Yeah, me personally, I had a friend this past February who took his life, and he was my age. He went to camp. And then, of course, that union, did you all heard about the union?
Mm-hmm.
And it's just kind of shocking for me. And my friends have had friends that have taken their lives and have attempted suicide. And I have friends that have attempted suicide. And, you know, they put up posters in the schools, and they say, hey, you know, if you ever want to talk to someone, well, it's like, what good does that do? There's posters on the wall. Like, no one gets up and does anything about it. And I completely agree with you. This is a serious
I'm getting problem. Up and doing something about it. But in our community, which we're very lucky to have that funding, I don't even have the records, but we're going to keep them, of the number of children who are sent in crisis to the hospital every single month from our high schools and middle schools in our district alone. It would be shocking to you about the lack of crisis services and the number of children who need them. And this is, it's outrageous, and it's such an issue. And I never want another phone call about a kid who blew their brains out.
Mm-hmm. And I think, personally, that they should be asked if they're being bullied. It's amazing.
We got bullying on the survey.
Do you? Okay.
Yep.
We're just showing you a small part.
Right, yeah. Right. That was probably really a really high number across all three grades, wasn't it? I mean, the number of...
For the 10th grade population, I want to say it was around 23%.
Higher in 8th grade, it gets lower as you go through 12th grade, but yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Is it, this is a very morbid question, but are most of the suicides gun-related?
Gun-related?
Are they?
Yes, in Battleground community they are. There have been two kids who haven't been, but four that have. By the way, those students are not students who are what we call externalizers. They're not kids who get bad grades or have trouble. They're children who are quiet and are great. All of them have been amazing children, but they're not typically what you would see as kids who identify through their behavior as problematic.
There's also a difference. So males attempt using guns more often, and women tend to take pills. So there's a higher rate of completion of suicide in males.
Except in Battleground, with Ben girls who have been shooting themselves.
I think there's a couple more slides, and she's got that.
Sorry.
First of all, okay, but when we look at all these students who are experiencing anxiety, worry, depression, it's majority female, about 60 to 70% are female, and only about
30%
male.
It's notable that 2/3 of adolescent females have attempted suicide. 2 out of 3.
Yeah, those that attempted suicide.
One is still.
It's one.
And then we look at the suicide rates in Clark. Just question. So on the slide it showed the percent of attempted suicide for 10th grade was 8.8, right?
Yes.
And then on the next slide where it says by gender, this 63% for female.
Yeah.
Is of those 8%.
Yes.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Of the
8%
of suicide, 63% of them are female.
Okay.
Yeah,
no.
That's what
thank you for interpreting that.
That's how I read it personally.
Yes. So we also see that suicide rate as a whole in Clark County has been going up for the past 2005, the age adjusted to 17.
So what would that look like? Have you looked at what that would look like if it wasn't all ages? If it was, let's say we were looking at suicides 18 and under, would it still be the same? How would we compare with the state, I guess?
I'd have to look that up, the trend for teenage suicides.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. I haven't looked at that, but that would be great to look at.
Okay, yeah, I'd be interested to see how we compare with the state averages. That is, you know, in our community, we hear about it every day, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. When we look at the breakdown by age, we actually see the rate or the age group more than the teenage suicide is 40 to 59-year-olds and our rate is 27.4 suicides or under 1,000 people. And then the breakdown by gender, it's very overwhelming for male because they tend to, go to these more extreme ways of violence.
So Clark County is what, 450,000 about?
About youth suicide?
We don't have a mental health and substance use advisory. We don't have two separate advisory boards anymore.
Board.
We now have one board because of the integrated health care.
Okay.
But what's going on is they have just started a behavioral health advisory board. It's a couple months, 3 months in along or whatever. Certainly that would be something if you wanted to be heard. I would go there and ask them what they're doing about it. Do they know anything about it? My voice is always there, and I'm always saying, look at this, what's going on here?
I'm not pointing fingers. I'm just saying that, you know, at one point in time, I know Rainey, that was before the early adopter program, but, you know, there was a mental health board, and we had talked about, you know, some of our issues that we address here, you know, were being addressed by the mental health advisory board. So I think it's something where we might want to collaborate with them, just like we're going to hear from the Commission on Aging tonight, you know, where we're really representing sort of, you know, public health in general. But yeah, there are some other entities, and, you know, this is an issue that we need to, as Sandy said, we need to make our community aware of this, make our counselors aware of this, and I'm not sure where the action comes from to make some and changes, et cetera, but the first thing is to make sure people are aware of this and that we need a community action plan. You know, working with our school districts and our law enforcement, you know, Bob's been talking about this for a couple of years.
You know, I think five.
Yeah.
Can I ask you a question, Amy, if you don't mind? So thank you for sharing your story about losing a friend.
Mm-hmm.
When that happened, were the rest of the students provided with any kinds of ideas or suggestions on what to do if they have concern about a friend that they think might be thinking about suicide?
He went to CAM and I go to Richfield. I was not in that school environment, but I was informed that there were a lot of therapists, I guess you could call them, at the school, and there were a lot of resources at the school. I'm not entirely sure, but as for, he was on the youth commission with me, and as for our group, we did get access to resources like that.
Good. I can speak to the CAM response. The Battleground School District has one of the most active and responsive SMART. SMART stands for school mobilization. That you respond if there's a tragedy.
Mm-hmm.
And CAM was one of the places we went. He was a brilliant young man.
He was amazing. Incredible.
as they all are, all of them. But it's been heartbreaking to see that happen and to see how many lives have been touched by that. We have a grant, our grant allows us to do something called Youth Mental Health First Aid. And we reached out to, for instance, the LDS church that he was involved with and the bishop there, and provided a Youth Mental Health First Aid training to like 30 parents who came a couple weeks later to get help with that. And there's just a whole response, which I'd rather spend my time talking about the prevention of, but my heart just goes out to every student who knew him. And Elena Jarvis also died recently, and she was the student who won the George C. Marshall Award and impacted literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people in this community, in the Battle Ground community. She just died, I think it was about a month ago, by suicide, self-inflicted gunshot wound. So it's absolutely a crisis and a tragedy that we don't need to ever have happen again.
Mary Jud Lisiak was just in Battle Ground doing a suicide prevention thing. Did you attend that?
I did not, but I'm familiar with Mary, and we're having a meeting tomorrow.
She's the trainer for the youth. Yeah. She'll go anywhere, anytime to train people on that, you know, her mental health first aid course. So, you know, we've tried to share that information. Mm-hmm. We went through the ACEs Action Alliance, and it's something that we can probably share here with her. Mm-hmm. She'll go anywhere, anytime to do that training for families or churches, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a good training.
Yeah.
We might see if we can get her here.
Yeah. We would love to host Youth Mental Health First Aid training for this community of folks. It's amazing. It's really a nationally known best practice. Mm-hmm. It is an 8-hour training that we're doing, but it's amazing. If you work with youth, you should probably have it.
Well, we might just get her here to address our group. Mm-hmm. You know, small synopsis of what, sure, you know, she is familiar with.
I did just want to comment, if there is something that's, if you mentioned a group that will react on this, I really do hope that they look at getting the help of youth, because oftentimes I feel like we're being talked at by a bunch, mm-hmm, of adults that don't really understand our point of view. So if you do find some, I hope they make sure that there is some sort of youth representative on that.
Absolutely.
That kind of will transition us to our next topic of discussion. So just, I'm sorry. Is there any more questions for Kathy?
Well, I think we need to continue to work on this. I mean, this is a huge issue. Probably need to think some more about it, and maybe come up with an action plan maybe at our next meeting. What are we going to do? What can we do to raise the awareness, and maybe even have a small group get together and look at what some of the options are with the Sandy, and come back with some recommendations, whether it's going to this new behavioral health board, or but we just can't listen to the data and not do anything.
Thanks, Kathleen.
Good presentation.
Yeah. So we were fortunate enough to have the opportunity to go to CRESA, and so we wanted to just check in and see what your thoughts were about that idea of possibly having off-site meetings in the future. Is that something that worked out okay and you might be interested in again, or?
Well, I know it was very eye-opening to me to see how it works. You never think about it. Dial 911. What comes into play, you know, that's the thing.
So as we mentioned, you know, we're looking for opportunities in the future that kind of enhances the council's knowledge and understanding for our community. So if there are possibilities for that in the future, we'll, you know, discuss that and see if that's something that everyone's interested in again. So thank you so much for participating.
Question about how does the new casino play into that?
You want to have a meeting at the casino?
Yeah, we're going to have a meeting there. That's what I asked. Yeah, but I'm wondering about how that plays with CRESA, mm-hmm, with the new casino. Okay. Yeah, that's the thing.
Do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Actually, there's still a lot of work being done with us and the first responder agencies in the casino. There's some challenges that we know will come as a part of that. The sheriff's office was able to reach an agreement as far as response within the last week. We still have some, as a sovereign nation, it creates some challenges for us.
Yeah, challenges is a good word.
And as far as how, depending on who you are, how you're treated, if there's an infraction, some of it has to fall within the federal jurisdiction, and some of it obviously can be handled by the sheriff's office. One of the biggest challenges will be just how to handle calls. The casino itself really hasn't identified either a first response team of their own or a police force of their own. We anticipate that we'll get calls on the casino from the patrons that are at the casino as well. So we're just trying to nail that down as far as how that's going to flow. But more to come. I guess we'll find out next week if they plan they're open.
When does it open?
24th.
The 24th?
Mm-hmm. I saw a commercial on TV, but how do you say the name of it? Yelani? I saw a commercial and they said the name of the casino differently than what I thought it would. So, does anybody know the correct pronunciation?
Actually, they say it's Ailani.
Yeah, that's right. So. Ailani, yeah. Not Ailani, but A. Yeah.
It's huge. We've been on the tour. 13 restaurants, a clothing store, and there's a convention center in phase two, will be a 400 room hotel.
Okay, and Adrian, are you going to give us an update?
Sure, yeah. So I was contacted by Washington Veterinary Medical Association's advisor, and it was sent out to all the Washington State veterinarians to support those kind of action alert to support funding for our most of the veterinarians in Washington utilize Washington State University's the animal WADL, which is the animal Washington Animal Diagnostic Laboratory. Diagnostic Laboratory or WADL, and so they're having a campaign for their capital budget for 2017-19 for $38 million to build a new laboratory facility. They get about, I guess, 300,000 examinations a year, and so their facility is very, very dated. I guess it's a 38-year-old building. So anyways, just getting that email and thinking, well, I could maybe support them with if everybody felt comfortable saying that our council supports that funding because it is directly impacts our public health mission. And, you know, they deal with avian influenza and they deal with bovine spongiform encephalitis. They do all the West Nile diagnostics and stuff. A lot of the communicable diseases gets filtered through there. And so it would be great to have like a statement to the legislation that we, as a committee or council support the funding that they're requesting. So that was just my thought.
It's the funding in the budget for the state legislature?
Yeah, and they're asking for us to contact our legislators and show support for funding the budget, the ask that they're doing for the $38 million new building they'd like to construct for animal diagnostics. It's the only building in Washington that does all of those. So that's really, if that was not there, it would be, I don't know what we would do, honestly. So, and I guess it sounds like it's to get accreditation and to be, to be able to do some of those services that you need in the building.
And did we find out where it's at in the...
I contacted her and it's open. It's still, they haven't. She said everything still stands. We still would like any, support or letters of support to the legislation, so it's not, nothing's gone through from what I understand. So we could make a letter or something, or I don't know if Roxanne, you can help me make a nice letter. We probably just use a lot of what's in there already that we just support.
Do you need a motion?
Yeah.
So that's where the rabies would, you know, somebody who suspected rabies that would go to that
rabies
lab
testing
or West
there,
Nile or those.
All communicable diseases. So I mean, there, and it says on there that they're, you know, the public health, that they're, they are the public health authority on communicable animal to human diseases. So that seems right where we would want to be.
So the only question I have for process is the charter bylaws for this council. I know that the bylaws have you as advisors to the Board of Health. I'm unclear on writing letters to the legislature. Jeff, do you know? You've been doing this longer.
Typically, we would ask the Board of Health or advise the Board of Health to write a letter, or ask permission for this body to write a letter. I think the latter would probably be most appropriate.
Would be to ask the Board of Health for permission for this council to send a letter directly to the, what's the timeline?
What Sherry said, nothing's moved on it yet, so we can follow the suggestions in this alert still. They will be working on the budget for a while this year.
We could even, you know, advise, you know, educate the Board of Health, Board of County Councilors, and then they could actually, you know, that's something that also happens is, you know, they go and they support, you know, the legislature. So, but it could come up at the Board of Health. We could bring it to their attention, and then they could decide whether, you know, whether they would want to add it in their, you know, their advocacy, or whether they, you know, want us to do it as a council. I think it's probably. I don't know, Jeff, I think, which one do you think would be the best?
That's up to this body.
I personally am not sure asking the Board of Health to do something like that right now would be a successful ask, given some of the dynamics of the current council.
Yeah, I think you guys, from my perspective, would be better off. I agree with Janice, asking them if it's okay for you guys to advocate.
Yeah, okay.
I mean, if to get them to do it, there's dynamics there, plus you're going to have to make a strong case. I think it'd be a lot easier for just the fact to write the letter.
Do you think it would help if the letter was already drafted so they have something to look at?
Yes. Okay. Plus, yes.
So, Jeff, do you know, would we need a motion for us to take it to the Board of Health on behalf of FAC?
I think so, yeah. Okay. Just to be safe, I would say.
So do we have a motion?
I move that we do that.
Mm-hmm. Second. Okay.
We're going to draft a letter on behalf of FAC.
Okay.
And then ask for Board of Health approval for FAC to send that.
But you think that's going to be okay?
I think so. We'll double check, but I think that's...
I don't want to...
It's fine. I'm sure it'll be fine.
Okay.
I'm confident it'll be fine.
I mean, because I could just send this email, and I mean, I could write something and say.
You could do that as well.
Just personally.
In fact, anyone here could as well.
Yeah.
Right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay. So after this motion, I guess we have to take a
vote. Oh, let's take a vote.
Yeah.
Okay. All of those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed?
So maybe I'll send you an email.
Okay, so we are going to move on to Marjorie, who's joined us to discuss the Commission on Aging. So thank you so much for coming.
People's table now, huh? I like sitting next to grandmothers. So I'm Marjorie Liddell. I've been the chair of the Commission on Aging this past year. When people think of aging, they think of older people. But one of our members had a baby this last year. I thought Allie did a lot for her image. The Commission on Aging, I don't know how many of you know, was formed in May of 2012, followed a 24-month study by a task force of people from across the county concerned about issues that might arise with the increasing aging population, which at that time was 1 in 5. And by 2030, it's expected to be 1 in 4 people will be over 65. So numbers tell people a lot. Since that time, there are 9 of us on the Commission on Aging, and the Aging Readiness Plan is what was developed from that study. It had 4 major areas: housing, transportation, healthy communities, and supportive services. This past year, we did an in-depth study on housing. We had people, 12 speakers who came in and spoke about different aspects of housing, from public housing to multifamily housing, to the need that we just don't have housing in which people are able to age in place. And I remember being a young mother looking for a house in Denver, Colorado that didn't have steps and was on one floor because I got tired of lugging things around. But builders like steps, and builders like the beauty of tri-levels and so on. So we lived in a tri-level. When my son was hit by a truck and had his pelvis broken, it was a problem. So, you know how it goes. So one of the things we learned from the people who came actually to our meetings, we had hundreds of people actually over the course of the year come to our meetings, telling us about their needs. The major need that came from the most people was people 50 and up were going to start looking for a home where it didn't have steps, where it'd be easier to manage. And they were there, some of them with lots of money in their pocket and no house to buy. So one of our speakers came from the Building Industry Association. We asked him, okay, this is what the people want. Why aren't you building that? He said, well, we hear you, but we haven't adjusted yet. So after our study, we came up with 3 recommendations that we made to the county council, and in fact, the county council was quite amenable to these recommendations. And since we made these recommendations, they have formed an internal housing task force based on studying our recommendations further, the recommendations of a housing expert who keynoted our summit, Housing Summit, in February, and what people brought up at that housing summit. So we are hopeful that they will be doing some of these things. The 3 things are: 1, when there is new construction, encourage — we didn't say mandate because we figured that to turn them off — encourage builders, developers, everybody involved in the process to consider making homes with 3 things that would be standard: a no-step entry, doorways and hallways that are wider so a person with a walker, or, carrying your bags to go on a trip or anything, the wall hallways would be wider, doorways would be wider, and a bathroom on the first floor. So that's what, in our world, that's what would be good for not just people 65 and over, but lots and lots of people. Second recommendation was incentives for people to retrofit, remodel, adjust their home in some way that would adapt toward those features. And while the county itself may not be able to offer tax incentives to residents, they certainly could incent remodelers to make it easier to develop. A lot of houses look alike, as everybody knows. And if you get standard drawings for one house with these features, it could be adapted for others. So with standardization comes an economy of scale. So we're hoping that they do that. The third thing is, when they think about new neighborhoods especially, and it'd be nice if they did old neighborhoods, I was encouraged that the city of Vancouver is going to put curb cuts in 164 corners this next summer. So we're saying, when there's a new neighborhood especially, don't waive the fees, but put in sidewalks where anybody and everybody can walk on those sidewalks, bike lanes. It needs to be communities that connect all ages, all abilities, and all incomes. So those were our 3 ideas. We had some marketplace ideas as well, working with the realtors, working with the BIA to come up with a model home to put in their yearly, what do you call it? Thank you, Joan. We had a speaker this evening at the Commission on Aging who spoke about memory loss. I think mine is normal at this point.
Right.
So that's what we did last year. Again, we deliberately did not use the mandate. And when I briefed our council, like I briefed each one of them one-on-one about what we were going to do based on the premise, no surprises. And each of them, and I stress each of them, was very open to this kind of conversation. And it was because we did not use the word mandate, not that we didn't want to, it would have felt good. But we figured, given the reality of where we live, it probably would have. But so next year, our focus is supportive services. And I think we would, and you helped us develop some of the areas in that. We've had two speakers now. The first one was on caregiver resources. And tonight we had Shanti Potts from AAA talk about aging and what is not normal aging. So that was a very interesting conversation. If you're over 65, your chances for dementia go up. So I suggested, well, let's just lie about our age. Keep you busy remembering your lies. So upcoming, we have pharmacists, elder justice, mental health speakers, socialization, that kind of thing. So that's the long and short of it. So if you have questions, I'm happy to answer those.
The Commission on Aging meets the same night that we meet, but it's a nice transition to go to their meeting from 4:30 to 5:30. Come over here, have dinner, and go to our meeting. So that's what I've been doing this last year. So
yeah, I was bribed with the dinner.
Yeah.
Where do you meet?
We meet on Franklin, the county building.
Public service building. Mm-hmm.
Is it open for everyone to attend?
Yes. And actually this, we noticed last year with taking a year-long focus and telling everybody what we're studying that we've developed quite a following, and CVTV even has us in the drop-down menu now.
All right.
So we feel like we've become, and we're 5 years old as of this year, so it takes a while to get your footing, but I think you found it.
I remember going to a huge community forum over at the Clark College. Was that the commission? It was huge, and there were a lot of people there that were really talking about making the community to where there was the corner grocery and that kind of stuff. And it was very nice. It was a good presentation. So. Mm-hmm.
I think the thing that I've learned going to the meetings this last year is, even when we had, and it was, council member Mark Bolt, who was really totally behind this in terms of looking at the demographics of our community and looking at the aging boomer population. And so, you know, we're sort of ahead of the game in our community. And one of the things that I think is really important, and we go back several years to some of the topics that we've had on our agenda about seniors, and I think if there's opportunities for us to collaborate from the Public Health Council with the Commission on Aging in terms of some of the things, especially some of the recommendations that they put forward to the council. And so if you know those recommendations, if we could also look at those, we could support the work of the Commission on Aging as they move forward, because as Marjorie said, the council's paying very close attention to what's coming out of the advisory groups and commissions in our community. And I think it's an opportunity for us to strengthen sort of our impact by supporting the work of like the recommendations on this housing from the Commission on Aging.
So the Commission on Aging is on the grid, and you can see audio and we can see video of all of your meetings, right? Just like our Board of Health meetings are on the grid.
So are your, do you have speakers lined up for this year? I know that you were looking at developing an agenda for the speakers. Do you have?
We pretty well have them, but if you have ideas, we're open.
And what kind of, who actually did we, who are the speakers that are going to be at these meetings coming forward?
Sue Doyle will be next time. She's occupational therapist, Clara Chambers, a pharmacist, and we don't yet have a pain management person identified that. And May is, I'm losing her name, we'll come back, Tony Golick from the Elder Justice Center in August, Peggy McCarthy, and Janet Regan for mental health.
From NOMI.
Okay. and Judy Cantor, I think, for socialization. Dr. Jamie Mackler, naturopath, complementary alternative medicine. And December, we do our work to prepare the report.
Judy Cantor is worth her weight in gold, yes. And Peggy McCarthy and Janet Regan, especially, that's a good couple of good people.
So there must be a pretty good partnership too with the media, right? Because the Columbian did a great story on universal design that sounds like it kind of timed into when you guys were discussing that, or maybe when you put forth your recommendations.
I call that a communication rollout.
That's fantastic. So
we knew early in the year that, well, housing is a big topic, it always is. So we knew that Patty Hastings from the Columbian was coming to our meetings on a regular basis. So we just stayed in contact with her, and at the right time, we said we could set up something and give her an exclusive and a sneak preview of the end of the year report, and first page, page one.
Yeah, that was a nice article. That was great.
The Commission on Aging is the only one in Washington. I think there are some around the country, but I'm told we're unique in that our staff support is housed within the county. And so residing in there, we're a little closer in, as you are. So I think it helps.
I think that we also hear that our council is unique, right? That it's very engaged in our community for the size, and so it's good that it's in other agencies as well. So anyone have any additional questions for Marjorie?
Thank you for the opportunity to be here. There's all these jokes about aging. I do have a favorite one. It's this long. It's too bad aging isn't a sin, because it would be more fun.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. All right, now I'd just like to open up the floor if there's any council members that have any additional updates. I know we did hear about ACEs earlier.
I have an announcement, which is the Public Health Community Award. It's going to be next Wednesday at the Board of Health meeting, April 26th. 26th. So I would encourage you all who can attend to show up and show your support for the winners and people who've done wonderful things for public health in our community. But I think you may have seen the news releases. Yeah, it starts at 8:30 a.m., so it's half an hour before the actual Board of Health meeting. And there's coffee and refreshments at 8:30, followed by the ceremony at about 8:45.
I was very pleased to see Charlie Mitchell's name on there. He is an incredible advocate and attorney in our community that works with
him. It's really tough to make a decision at this time, because there were so many wonderfully qualified people. Mm-hmm.
It just seems a little unusual. There's an attorney on here, but I was really glad to see it. He's very involved and invested in our community.
So one thing I wanted to say is just thank you to our guests for coming. We very rarely have public members that come to our meetings, and we are trying to get the word out. So we appreciate your interest. And certainly, if you have any questions going forward, you're welcome to contact any one of us with regard to any questions or any help that we could be with the work that you're doing. And we just appreciate, again, like I said, we appreciate the interest. So thank you for taking the time.
You know, since she's, you're working on radon, what's your 2-minute speech on radon that we need to know?
Well.
In August,
I started my project by looking at the data, and by
talking about that lung cancer is one of the diseases in the community that's the highest disease of death rates in the community. Looking at that data, I had no idea what radon was or that we have the highest potential for it. Since then, I have been contacting many different organizations, builders, I've contacted Rogers, who's a physicist from the state of Washington, and I've contacted some people in Oregon and went to the Northwest Radon Coalition and spoke to a representative, a manager at the American Lung Association. So I'm learning quite a bit and never knew what radon was until August. And I'm finding that it is a problem in our community and an opportunity to improve the health of our community. My project is awareness. Bring about awareness. That's the beginning. Testing. It's, you know, you don't hear about it. But when you look on the internet and you look in different sites, it's all there. The EPA has a lot of good information about it. So.
Do you know if in Washington, when you tell your home in Oregon or house had radon, you just live in an area with where it was an old home and we had a basement, and so when you sell your home, you're required to test. Generally, the realtors will always ask that. Is that something that you know?
No regulations
in Washington.
No regulations at all. It's
in Oregon either.
Oregon is a little bit stronger. Stronger as far as I just met a realtor yesterday that she's trying to put the language in buyer and seller contractual language.
It is, and because I went through it with ours, if you have any mitigation, if they will scope your sewers, they're testing for radon. If you have an old house, those are the two big things that you're going to get done, and you have to put that on all of the contract forms. But I don't remember that being in Washington.
Not Washington. As of 2010, I believe that the builders follow code for the venting, as well as the membrane barrier to the ground, which is supposed to support the ventilation of radon. Mm-hmm. But in Clark County, there's only been 5,033 tests actually done out of the population.
But you can go to Home Depot or one of these stores,
and you can
actually do your own.
Yeah.
About 6% of homes in the United States have radon, so it's common. But you can actually do some. Yeah, well, uranium is a naturally occurring substance, and radon is a byproduct of that. And given the half-life of uranium, radon will be with us for another few billion years. But it's the second most common cause of lung cancer in the United States. But it pales in comparison to tobacco. So tobacco is still responsible for about 90%. But radon and tobacco are also synergistic with each other, so that's a bad combination. But you can
smoking in your old house basement, bad idea.
So you can but you can get a home testing kit. They're not real expensive, and but you can have two houses, one next door to each other, and the same one has it and the other one doesn't. So anyway.
All right, any other comments? Do we use a motion to end the meeting?
I think.
Does anyone have a motion that we are done?
Adjourned.
Adjourned. Thank you.
We don't have to vote on that one.
I don't have a meeting for. Oh, we're in.